Now, I was talking about the brutality of Rome and concurring with the Iowa's evaluation of Rome. And what I did to verify that what he said was accurate. And, you know, God rather likes it when we test what he says. We verify what he says. Now, prophecy, well, this was a prophetic statement at the time that Yahweh issued it. He was speaking to Daniel in Babylon around the 6th century BCE. Rome didn't exist at the time. Wasn't even a whisper of Rome. So it was prophecy when it was issued, all of it, right through the end of time. Now, a tiny fragment of it is prophecy. That's the integration and the evolution of the Roman Empire into the Roman Catholic Church is still going to menace humankind for the next 19 or 20 years. But that essentially is the prophecy when it was issued. And so to test prophecy to see, you know, did God get it right is always interesting. So I went through and I devoted about 400 pages writing to Rome. You know, first I decided it would be appropriate since God had a lot to say about Babylon and Assyria and Persia and the Median Empire and particularly Alexander and the Hellenistic conquests and then Rome. I covered them all. Learned a lot. I was really surprised about what I learned about Babylon and what I learned about Medio Persia and what I learned about Alexander. Particularly Alexander, so very different than in reality than he is depicted in the cursory views of history. But especially Rome. And because Yahweh told us that Rome was a vicious animal, I chronicled all of Rome's battles, every significant battle fought by Rome from the very beginning of the Roman Republic all the way through the demise of the Western Roman Empire. All of them. And you can read that. It's an interesting review of history. And oh my, what despicable, depraved human beings. Now, in addition to that, because Yahweh was insisted that the nature, the character of this beast was abysmal, and this beast was an abomination, and that this beast would transition into an entity that would ravage the whole world. Unlike these other beasts, which just ravaged regions, this would be a beast that would ravage the whole world. So what I wanted to do is I also chronicled the lives of the emperors, particularly the emperors beginning with the first of them, Julius Caesar. Fascinating study of Julius Caesar and how Julius Caesar was very much like Paul. He wrote about himself, self-glorification, Julius Caesar's fight against the establishment of Rome, which he was once part of, for his own unique glorification. Very much like Paul. And so I covered Julius Caesar and then, of course, Octavian, who became, collectively there July and August on our calendars. And this transition within Rome where the leaders of Rome, the Caesars, became gods and they had shrines devoted to them and where the Roman emperors were also commander in chief of the armed forces. As a matter of fact, the military was the dominant factor in Rome. It covered the caste system. Most people don't know that Rome had a caste system, but it did. And it was interesting to discuss the Roman emperors, particularly right before, during, and immediately after Yahusha. the likes of Caligula, the likes of Claudius, the likes of Nero. Oh, my. What repulsive human beings. And, of course, I detailed the interactions between Rome and the province of Yehuda, Judah. And, oh, the viciousness, the hatred. Horrible. And it was interesting to look at Titus and Vespasian and their attack on Rome and how they turned Yahweh's temple into the Roman Colosseum and to compare and to contrast the purpose of those two edifices. It's the perfect metaphor for the transition between the Roman Republic and what became Roman Catholicism. And then thereafter with Hadrian and how Hadrian literally played Jews for fools. After, you know, his predecessors had completely destroyed the temple and had completely welched on all of their promises to the province of Yehuda and positioned legions there to restrict their freedoms. Hadrian said, came back and he said, standing on the Temple Mount, why don't you all your Jews that fled Israel during the war of the first rebellion against Vespasian and Titus, and why don't you all come back and we'll rebuild this city and we'll rebuild the temple. Come back. And they did. And once they came back, Hadrian went back on the Temple Mount with and unfurled his scroll of plans and said, you know, this is no longer Jerusalem. I'm naming this city after myself. We're not going to build a temple to Yahweh here. We're going to build a temple to me here. Yeah, a temple to Hadrian. Giant statues of Hadrian here. And we might put one of Jupiter next to it. And we're going to have all these broad Roman boulevards and a Roman forum. And this is going, we're going to turn Jerusalem into the ultimate vacation destination for Roman legions. Well, of course, the Jews revolted. Exactly as you would expect they would have done. And that started a war that Hadrian baited the Jews into fighting. And as a result of that war, really nothing was left of the province of Yehuda. The land was salted. Jews by the hundreds of thousands were either starved to death or crucified. Jews were hauled off into Europe and throughout Rome as slaves. Became illegal for a Jew to own anything written in Hebrew, including the Torah. Hebrew scholar was wrapped in a moistened copy of the Torah and then burned alive. It was pretty despicable. And you see from this transition, then, how a religion could arise that was opposed to its own roots. Christianity as a religion is wholly opposed to the Torah, which is its, you know, should have been its basis. It's opposed to the prophets, which should have been its basis. It's opposed to Yahweh, who should have been its God. So how did a religion like Christianity, which is opposed to its own foundation, arise and become so popular? And what you find when you study the Rome and its emperors and its attitude at this time, how that's possible. How the Romans came to hate everything that was associated with Hebrew. Jerusalem, Israel, the Hebrew language, the Torah, Yahweh, who is their God. And so it is in this culture that Paul was able to conceive a religion that was wholly opposed to its, what should have been its basis. I mean, it was one of the most insane acts ever perpetrated on humanity. I mean, the very concept of Christianity, where they take this individual named Yahusha, which means Yahweh saves, who was not only Torah observant, but was observing the first four mikra, he himself becoming the basis of the first four mikra, and you have a religion that completely disregards the fact that he is Jewish, that this is taking place in Yisrael, that this is all being played out on Mount Moriah in Jerusalem. That everything he is saying is confirming the Torah. That he is the living embodiment of these first four invitations to meet with God. And yet you have a religion that renames him, that disassociates him entirely from the Torah and from these invitations that he himself fulfilled. It's insane. Well, the insanity required, the warped perspective required for a religion that out of context, that revisionist, to appeal to a mass number of people, is all laid out for us in Roman culture. And that was the great benefit of studying Rome. And it's the basis, really, of the second of the two chapters on the beast that is Rome, that you'll find in the seventh volume of Yad Yah. And so what this stone affirms is what Roman history affirms. That the Romans, rather than being a great empire, you know, an empire that America emulates in so many different ways, that Rome's despicable. The Romans were brutal. They were vicious. They were anti-Semitic. They were as ungodly as any people who have ever lived. Absolute beasts, menaces to humanity. And so this Latin engraving verifies what God said is true. So returning to this article, now that you have some background, it says Israeli archaeologists Tuesday have discovered a large stone with Latin engravings that lends credence to the theory that the reason the Jews revolted against Roman rule nearly 2,000 years ago was because of their harsh treatment. Israel's Antiquity Authority, Israel's Antiquity Authority, said that the stone bears the name of the Roman Emperor Hadrian, who, in my view, is amongst the most miserable abominations ever to walk this planet. And the year of his visit to Jerusalem, which is where he hoodwinked Jews, saying that he was going to rename the Jerusalem after himself. A few years before the failed Bar Kokhba revolt in the second century, the inscription backs up the historical accounts that Rome's 10th Legion was present in Jerusalem at the run-up to the revolt. The cause of the Jewish revolt, which resulted in their exile, is disputed. Nah, it's not disputed. It's obvious. Rome was vicious. Rome was pagan. Rome was anti-Semitic. Rome was ungodly. Rome was despicable. Rome was brutal. It is unclear whether they rose up independently or provoked by harsh Roman measures. No, it isn't. There's no question here. Harsh Roman treatment, Roman duplicity, Roman immorality. And read what I wrote. I mean, it's so obvious as to why the revolt occurred. Hadrian is reviled in Jewish history for imposing dictates at persecuting Jews and forcing them to abandon their religion. Not just the religion. He made it illegal to own a copy of the Torah, to have any document written in Hebrew, to be circumcised, to even be one of Yahweh's chosen people in Israel. This article is promoted by the written by the Associated Press, it says, along with the Jewish accounts, the history of Bar Kokhba revolt is also known from the works of the Roman historian Cassius Dio. Cassius Dio is a despicable man. He was unbelievably anti-Semitic. He helps explain. Now, Cassius Dio is important, even though he is wholly unreliable. The reason that he's important is that as a Christian historian, he demonstrates the mindset of the scribes who transcribed the letters that composed the Christian New Testament. There was no correlation of any kind between what Cassio Dio wrote and actual history. He changed everything to suit his own personal agenda. And that is the mindset that existed within Christianity. History meant nothing. Truth meant nothing. Facts meant nothing. So that's how you got a religion that is completely disjoined from what should be its foundation, is the mindset of the first Christians like Cassio Dio. He wasn't a historian. He was a storyteller. Hello, Kirk. How are you today?
I'm doing good. I was calling about something else, but okay. You're in the middle of the history stuff, so I didn't want to break your thought on that. But I've been out of town, so we started looking and listening to everything on the tapes, on the archives.
Uh-huh.
And I liked what you've actually done this a couple of times. I liked what you were doing on Friday night show where you were speaking of Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And he put it this way: you were asking questions, you know. And I wrote down some of the quotes that you said, and then I wrote a couple of things of my own, which I thought were most appropriate, but kind of personalized it. But you said,
that's consistent with what we're talking about, because the only reason that I went into such length, Kirk, to describe the attitude of Rome and how Rome is going to infect the entire world as Roman Catholicism and the prophecies of Daniel, was to help explain how a religion like Christianity could grow on such a lie, could be popular when it was so resolutely disassociated from all evidence and reason.
Yeah. Well, the questions that you ask, if that's not too far afield from where you were, I'll quote a couple of things that you said, and you were speaking of a Christian, you said, I really love God, but, and then you went on to say, I don't use his name.
Right.
I don't know his name or really care when confronted with it.
Right.
I don't want his plan for my salvation.
Nope.
Because I've invented another one.
Yep.
Shall we continue?
Yeah, why don't we continue after the break? We'll have a long segment coming up. And what you're doing is you're synthesizing what we discussed, where you're presenting really the attitude of Christians, even though they themselves wouldn't acknowledge this. This is really what they're saying. I love God, but don't know his name and don't like his plan. We'll be back. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm Yoda. We're having a conversation here with Kirk. And Kirk is reviewing the attitude that's required to be a Christian. And the first thing that you said, Kirk, was that as a Christian, I love God, which is a title, but I not only I don't know his name, when somebody tells me his name, I actually get mad at them. I try to demean them. I won't use his name, and I'm actually angry. I put somebody in a box, and I will speak negatively of them if they tell me that God has a name, that it's Yahweh, and that I should use it. I'll lash out at them negatively, aggressively opposing his name. And the next thing he said is the Christians, I love God, but I don't like his plan. That plan that he laid out in the Torah, where I have to do as Yahusha did, which is to observe the Mikra. I'm not doing that.
I'm going to save by grace.
Yeah, I'm going to be saved by grace. And grace is an interesting word. It's actually a name. Mm-hmm. It's a transliteration of the Latin gratia. Cute little naked girls, right?
Mm, absolutely.
Yeah, so if you think you're saved by grace, you're pointing at the Romans, who God said were beastly, and they're goddesses of decadence and merriment and of lascivious living.
Yeah, they say about three little naked pagan girls. That'll do it.
That'll do it. Yeah, man. Yeah. if it wasn't so sad, it would be funny.
It is if in context, you know, if you keep it out of context.
Yeah, salvation by grace. Yeah, okay. So we're there with the naked little girls. That'll work.
I don't listen or read his word, and that now the Messiah and every witness writer said his word was the Torah.
Yeah, absolutely, and they not only don't read the Torah, they hate the Torah. When you speak of the Torah and being Torah observant, they get angry.
Yes.
I mean, it's not just that they don't pay attention to the Torah. They hate the Torah. And anytime you approach a Christian and say, are you Torah observant? Of course not. Well, you know, that's Yahweh's foundational testimony. It's where he introduces himself to us. It's where he presents his covenant relationship. It's where he explains how to engage in a relationship with us. It's where he presents his plan of salvation. Why, you know, why don't you listen to it? Well, it's been done away with. It's been annulled. It's been replaced.
There are billions of words that have been spoken and letters written and everything. Can you find one group of documents that are true beyond the Torah? I mean, other than, you know, one.
The prophets and the Psalms prove their inspiration, but
there's nothing else.
But that's it. Yeah, and Yahweh gave us a really explicit means to determine whether or not he inspired someone who claimed to speak for them. He presents this in Devarim twice and at Deuteronomy. And when you read the Christian New Testament, it doesn't mesh with his test. In fact, it's rejected by his test, particularly Paul's letters.
Where does
God say that his Torah is temporary?
And nowhere.
Where does he say that what I want you to do is subtract everything from the Torah and add an entirely New Testament?
No, he contradicts that constantly, both in the Torah and Yosha's out of Yosha's mouth.
Where does Yahweh say that the Torah is for the Jews only?
Nowhere. He says just the opposite.
Yeah. Where does he say that these invitations to meet with him that begin with Pesach that are Jewish holidays?
Nowhere. They're his. They're anyone who wants to be part of his family.
Where does he say that his name is too sacred to pronounce?
Well, it wasn't too sacred to pronounce 7,000 times.
It was written 7,000 times in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. Obviously, nowhere. It's just so amazing, the Christian mindset. I claim to love God, but I don't want to listen to what he has to say. I don't want to pay any attention to the plan that he offered. I'm opposed to his name. I'm opposed to his foundational treatise. Opposed to everything that he said and did. I'm opposed to his people. I'm opposed to his promised land.
Mm-hmm.
So how can you pretend that you love God and be opposed to everything that he stands for?
Well, you're just a living contradiction then. I mean, you know, the next thing I think that I do listen, speaking of the Christian again, I do listen and quote Paul's contradictions. I support him and spread the gospel, you know, financially and constantly with my own. So that's what you're required to do as a Christian or supposed to do as a Christian.
Yeah. And yet, what did Yahweh say about Paul and through his prophet Habakkuk?
He said he was a plague of death.
Yeah.
Spreading, and that's what you're spreading, death.
Death. Did he make any comment about the audience that Paul would infect?
Well, he said the goyim. He would be them.
Yeah, they'd be the Gentiles, the non-Jews would be the audience that he would infect with his poison. He also warned us that he would be opposed to circumcision, and Paul turned out to be the enemy of circumcision. Correct?
Yes. Well, that was his first big fight.
Yeah. Yahweh said that he would claim to be a rabbi, and yet he wasn't, and that he would claim to be appointed to speak for God, and yet that wouldn't apply to him either. In fact, Yahweh tells us, warns us about Paul exactly 666 years before Paul penned his first letter.
Mm-hmm.
And he told us that Paul would be present at the time that the Moed were being fulfilled.
And
indeed he was.
To that, yes.
Yeah. Yep. And speaking to Paul, he says, you know, why don't you question him? What does Shaul, Paul's given name, mean?
It's the question, or the place of question. And if you, it's the same word as just with a different pointing. It's the same word as Sheol.
Yeah, which is the equivalent of hell.
Separation. Yeah.
Yeah, place of separation, and it means Sheol means, and Shaul means to question him. Didn't Yahweh say in the Habakkuk warning regarding Shaul that no one who values him will find satisfaction?
Mm-hmm.
So, since Paul is the basis of Christianity, since he's the essence of the Christian New Testament, what does that say about the Christians who value him?
Well, you know, even further, if you're going to build your case, and Christians are very big in prophecy. I know when I was, and but which prophecy can you just not use those prophecies if he's true? I mean,
if you look at Paul, he only made two predictions. One was about
if you're quoting Habakkuk. If you're quoting Habakkuk, you know, if that's true.
Yeah.
If the others are true, how come that one's not all of a sudden?
Oh, yeah, I know. That would be a real problem for Pauline Christians is that, wait a minute, you're saying that the prophecies in your Bible are all true. Well, how come the Habakkuk 1 and 2, which is a prophecy regarding the plague of death named Shaul, Paul, how come that one's not true?
Yeah. I mean,
I was going to go and say, all right, if prophecy is the way that you prove that God authored something, which is what God says, then how come Paul gave only two predictions? So
wrong.
In his 13 letters, he offers only two predictions, and both of them he got wrong.
Yeah. Well, why does he never quote the Messiah that he represents?
Yeah, how come he says that he was chosen to present the Son to the world, and that he was chosen in the womb to represent the Son to the world, and he never once quotes him, not once accurately. He takes a snippet of something that he said and twists it and misquotes him, but he doesn't. There's not a single accurate quote, not one in all of Paul's 13 letters.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, what he says of him is exactly the opposite of what he said of himself. So how can he be presenting him if he contradicts him in every meaningful way?
It's absurd. It's absurd.
Yeah.
If I was presented with this, I never viewed Christianity quite this way because I never read Paul that much. I read Matthew and I read Genesis and the Psalms and the Prophets and and Revelations. I mean, that was
in terms of the documentation of an eyewitness account of Yahusha's life, his words and deeds, there really is only one quasi-reliable account, and that would be the account in Matthew. Once you leave Matthew, the accuracy of these statements plummets. And I think part of that is because for some time, the original account of Matthew was written in Hebrew. The words were spoken, of course, in Hebrew. They were written down in Hebrew. And the Hebrew scribes were meticulous, where the Greek Christian scribes were ridiculously errant, revisionist. And so I think that had something to do with it. Of course, Matanyahu was an eyewitness. Now, you could also say Yahochanan John was an eyewitness.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem with Yahochanan's work is because it was so favored by early Christians, it is really subject to revisionism. I mean, the most famous story in Yahochanan is the story of the adulterous woman and him writing in the dirt and then saying he that was without sin cast the first stone. That story never occurred. It's not even found in any of the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, or 7th century manuscripts.
Mm-hmm.
Not once, not even mentioned. So it didn't occur. It's made up. There's so much that is made up. So, and then you look at Mark and Luke, and they're hearsay. They're neither were present And neither account was written within even a reasonable amount of time from the point the events occurred.
Yeah, in light of the revelation of Paul's and his close association with Luke, I mean, I have no interest in it to begin with.
I mean, no. I tried to read it the other day. I mean, I said, you know, I'm just going to read it. I'm doing a lot of exercise now. I've lost a little over 30 pounds, and you know, I'm really trying to. I've got an anniversary here that's coming up, and I promised my wife I'd be at the same weight I was 30 years ago when we were married. And so I've got a lot of time So I said, I'll just take and read the so-called Christian New Testament from beginning to end. And I really enjoyed reading through Matthew.
Mm-hmm.
I had a real tough time with Mark.
Mm-hmm.
And then Luke, what I found in Luke is that he just got everything twisted. He's got statements that from Matthew know that Yosha made this statement in this context, and Luke's got it all over the board. And he's got the timing twisted. He's got the words twisted. I found about two-thirds of the way through Luke, I just couldn't do it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Just couldn't do it. I just gave up. I said, okay, I'll jump ahead to Yahochan and John. Wasn't much better. Welcome back to Shattering This. No, just fundamentally, Kirk, when you think about what's required to be a Christian, it's amazing that you have a religion that is so influential in the world and in people's lives, that is so at odds with itself. I mean, it's a living contradiction. Paul's words contradict God's. Paul's presentation of Yosha is the antithesis of Yosha's presentation of what's important. You have a religion that is anti-Semitic, anti-Israel, anti-Jew, anti-Torah, and yet these are the things that God loves.
Mm-hmm.
How do you perpetrate such an obvious lie on so many people and have so many people, you know, fight to the death for what is clearly an error?
Well, you know, the simple fact that when you present somebody with this and you say these things to people and they get so hostile, it tells you that they know on some level that this is wrong, that this is right and they're wrong.
Right.
Because that's why they're being hostile.
Yeah, you tell a Christian, wait a minute, you know, there's no basis of Christmas, and from God's perspective, it's a Babylonian holiday. And there's no basis for Easter. It's a Babylonian holiday. There's no basis for Sunday, much less worship. Both are Babylonian concepts. There's no basis for calling God the Lord. There's no basis for the Trinity. Babylonian. You know, there's no basis for the name Bible. It's completely Egyptian and pagan. And you can go through and name a thousand things. There's no basis for church. There's no basis for Christian. There's no basis for Jesus. There's no basis for Christ. How many lies are you willing to accept for a faith that dominates your life?
Well, I told a lot of people about Christmas, and then when Easter came around, and I said, well, let me tell you about Easter now. And they absolutely said, don't you dare destroy another holiday for me.
Wow. Yeah, don't let the truth get in the way of my religion.
Yeah.
I want to be religious, and I want to celebrate these religious holidays, and how dare you demonstrate to me that I'm celebrating a pagan distortion, a lie. I'm doing something that upsets God as opposed to pleasing God.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this myth that there was a bodily resurrection, and that's the basis of Easter. No, there wasn't. I mean, it's obvious that there wasn't. It would be counterproductive. And the eyewitness testimony all say it did not happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go and you name this after Esther, the mother of God, the queen of heaven, and a central ingredient into the Babylonian religion. Come on, think.
Yeah. You know, who wants to be a bodily? Let me tell you, the other day we were up in the High Sierras, and 7,000 feet, it gets cold.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking to myself, you know, this is one of those times when I wish I could jump in, change my matter.
Yeah.
Spiritually.
Yeah.
Get real warm because I'm freezing. I was thinking, so who would want that kind of buddy if they couldn't change it?
Oh, absolutely.
So,
you know, there are times where I like having a physical body. You know, there are times when it's really pleasant outside, and then you feel the warmth of the sun, yeah, and a gentle breeze, and there's some foods and some drinks and things that it's really nice to have a physical body.
Absolutely.
But there are times, great examples. Right before I began the show, I did an hour and a half of exercise, mm-hmm, and to have to devote, and there's no part of the exercise that, boy, this is really enjoyable.
No.
You know, I'm on a gym and alternate between a gym and a stationary. There's no part of it that says this is enjoyable, and I'm doing it to keep this physical body from deteriorating.
Yeah.
And there are times when it is a real liability.
Is that the eternal body you want?
No.
Think so.
No. No, I don't want to have to diet in eternity. I don't want to have to get up and do an hour and a half of exercise every day and have this soreness. And I don't want to look in at the midsection and see a ring of a flab. You know, no, it's not. And you know, you and I are healthy. You know, we won the lottery in terms of good genes and don't have anything that's materially wrong with us. Otherwise, it'd be, you know, vastly worse. I mean, who are we to complain?
Mm-hmm.
We don't have an ailment that's in any way serious or debilitating. And yet, no, I don't want to spend eternity in this body. Are you kidding? No way.